Okay, people are signing back in. That's good. And everybody should be muted out. I'm going to look at our little chat line. Jim, thanks for letting me know that everything is clear. And Michael as well. So I appreciate it. So I got a couple of notes. Everybody should be able to hear me. And you should be able to see the screen at this point. Welcome back to our webinar, Originating the Self-Employed Applicant, or Liar Loans Are Gone. My name is Dave Hirschman, and this is a Certified Mortgage Advisor webinar. Those of you who don't know me, and we do have some new people this week, I've been in the industry 30 years. I started as a top producer with almost 600 transactions my first 18 months in the industry. I became a production executive. I've written 7 books and hundreds of articles for the industry, making me, I guess, the top author. And I helped found the Federal Bank, and I've been a keynote speaker at hundreds of industry events. I am the proprietor of OriginationPro.com, the founder, and of the Certified Mortgage Advisor Program as well. Our goals today, we're going to go through a legislative update. We've been spending a lot of time on legislation in the past 2 months and, you know, really for the last year and a half, and hopefully we'll be able to shorten that part of it up soon. Obviously, interest peaked as the comp plans were being implemented. We're going to go over the history of self-employment, a quick update on our services, why this topic is important, types of self-employment, documentation required, the profit and loss statement, less than 2 years self-employed, income calculations, and we are going to have a case study, but we're not going to go through each tax return line by line, obviously because of time constraints. And it's more important to understand what the tax returns mean. Many loan officers are looking for a fill-in-the-blank solution, and I know some have it. I call them, you'll have to excuse what I call them, but I'll explain why sometime in the future. We call them idiot forms, you know, fill-in-the-blank, and hopefully you get the right number. But if you don't understand the meaning, you'll be missing important opportunities. Again, we'll be presenting a very simple case study as part of this webinar. And as always, we're going to give you the chance to ask questions on this topic and any topic at the end of the webinar. We believe that coaching is an important part of the Certified Mortgage Advisor Program. I don't care if your question's on sales, your question's on one of our programs or services, or it's on self-employment or legislation. Interaction is extremely important, that we can be with you and help you answer questions. And sometimes it's not me that knows the answers, but somebody else who's listening on the line. And by the way, we'll also be finishing up with a little segment on marketing the self-employed as well. Hang on for a second before I go on to the news brief. I am going to just spend one moment clearing my throat. I've got some allergies today, and I don't want to be hoarse throughout the presentation, but I want to move away from the mic so I don't hurt your ears while I do it. So hang on for a second. I'll be back in about 10 seconds. Okay, I'm back. We have a little cold front come in Orlando. It's only supposed to be 85 today. So I know you guys are all experiencing the same weather. Let's go to our news group. One of the biggest stories of the last week was the potential shutdown of the government over the budget negotiations. And right now, there has been an extension of 1 week. So we now have another deadline coming this Friday. But unlike last week, there was not a general agreement on the format for the cuts, which are going to amount somewhere around 38 billion. So supposedly, and I say supposedly because anytime you're talking about politicians in Congress, you never know how it's going to go out, but supposedly there will be a more permanent resolution that will keep government funded till the end of the fiscal year, which is September 30th. However, it doesn't mean the debt debate's going to go away. There's going to be a lot of saber rattling going on. And also, in mid-May, it is projected that the government is going to bounce to the top of its debt limit, which is about $14.7 trillion, somewhere in that range, give or take a dollar or so. And again, that is an opportunity for certain members of Congress to rise up and refuse to increase the debt limit, even though that means everything stops, even Social Security payments and so forth. So you wouldn't envision it would happen for very long if it did happen, but there's going to be another debate, you can be sure, in the next month. So this, even though we may not be under a major threat of a shutdown right now, the issue is going to be front and center for the next few months, and truthfully, for the next few years. It'll be part of the next presidential election campaign, certainly. Also, as you know, keep in mind that the qualified residential mortgage standards, which are I have a summary of on the next slide, have been introduced for comment. We're halfway through that comment period, and there's going to be a lot of lobbying concerning that. Also, there's a slew of bills that have been introduced to shut Fannie and Freddie within 2 years, and that has major ramifications for the industry. A couple of other things that popped up, most of these things are older on this slide, but I want to give you a major reminder that April 18th is the increase for FHA premiums. We put a note in your consumer newsletter this week so you could get that out to anybody you have that's potentially a client right now. But keep in mind, this is just a few days away. A lot of times a premium increase, of course, that's a negative thing, but right now it could be an opportunity for you to bring in some more business. There was also a comment on the American Bar Association meeting this week, American Bankers Association meeting this week, which I think was in Baltimore, somebody making a comment, even though the Consumer Finance Bureau is going to be working on a one-page truth in lending good faith estimate form, that it will literally take years to implement a form like this. And so even though the Finance Bureau says they're working on it right away, they're going to come out with it, doesn't mean it's going to be implemented right away. Here is the slide which summarizes the qualified residential mortgage rules that have been proposed, which include 28-36 ratios, 20% down payment, and no 60-day lates within 24 months. And mortgage insurance is not included. You can't have 5% down with mortgage insurance to basically make it a qualified residential mortgage, and you could be sure that the MI companies are going to be lobbying against that. There's an exemption for government guaranteed assets, and that includes FHA. And Fannie and Freddie right now are government because they're, you know, basically owned by the government, and VA and so forth. But think about this for a second. If this goes through the way it's supposed to go through right now, or the way it's been proposed, and Fannie and Freddie went away, imagine what would happen to FHA. FHA would be completely deluged with business. I could envision FHA being 60-70% of the market, and of course, as a reaction, FHA would have to tighten up even more. So there's major ramifications here. These risk retention proposed rules, along with the proposal to eliminate Fannie and Freddie, again, as I mentioned before, really have more important consequences than the change in loan officer compensation. Speaking of loan officer compensation, I have a summary of what happened there, but I wanted to flip to the slide that says, what are the possibilities going forward? Well, we know now the Fed didn't step forward and delay the rules to let the legal process play out. Did I expect the Fed to become reasonable all of a sudden? No, I didn't, and it didn't happen. Also a possibility, the associations dropped their appeals. Well, based upon their statements in the last week, that's not likely to occur. The associations have said they will fight on. Of course, the problem is the new compensation rules will stay in effect while they fight on. It could be that Congress could take action to delay or water down the rules. But keep in mind, Congress is knee-deep in the budget right now, and so they have, I hate to say this, but bigger fish to fry with so many things going on. And at the end, remember, the provisions for the Dodd-Frank Act are very similar to the Fed rules that were released. So even if the Fed rules were watered down, unless the Act was changed, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau would be issuing its own set of rules anyway. In other words, this is coming one way or the other, but hopefully the Bureau would be more reasonable. Certainly the Fed has been less than reasonable in certain areas. Now, I mentioned last week and the week before that HUD has issued a good faith estimate direction. What I've done for this week is I actually cut and pasted the examples into the verbiage that was included in the letter. I think there's four different examples. The first example is a flat fee compensation of $4,000 where the lender is paying for the mortgage broker compensation. So what this appears like is that the borrower is getting a credit for $4,000 of the interest rate. So it looks like YSP from my concern. So in essence, we were told at the beginning that YSP was going to be eliminated. It wasn't eliminated. It sort of now takes a different form. In this case, the mortgage broker compensation is a flat fee of $4,000, so the origination charge is $4,500, including the lender charge. However, since the lender is paying the broker, it actually shows the $4,000 credit. The other example is, this is an example of a no-cost, but there's actually two no-cost examples, one where everything is paid for by the lender using, again, YSP, obviously, but in this case, it is not everything. It's just the origination charges, not the other third-party charges. So in this case, you have origination charge of $4,500, you have a lender credit of $4,500, but you still have $3,000 charges for other settlement services. The last two examples are examples that are either that are negative or positive with regard to the lender credit above the mortgage broker fee. And so it goes both ways. I think the first one, looking at it, is a negative. So there's actually a $500 charge. And the second one is a positive. So there's actually a $500 credit. And I know I'm going through these quickly, and they can be confusing, but keep in mind, I've got the verbiage from the letter from FHA included on each of these slides. And remember, you're going to be able to download these slides tomorrow. So we will have these up on the screen tomorrow. Okay. I'm also checking the screen to make sure we have no technical difficulties. So if I pause or hesitate, that's typically what I'm doing. Now, just a quick overview on what you guys get as part of our system. Well, obviously, one of the things you're getting is you get access to the Certified Mortgage Advisor Program. You're getting access to the Newsletter Pro Marketing System. That was our consumer newsletter I mentioned just a moment ago, and a free package, which includes our first-time buyer marketing kit. That's all of that is $39. If you're on a trial, you know, your payment's going to go up only from $9 to $39 if you stay on, and you will automatically be extended unless you email us or call us to let us know. Now, there is an upgrade to the RateLink Market Advisory Service at $59.95 a month. That is inclusive of all the other services, so it's only $21 more. Why do we put all these together? Because becoming an expert is not enough. Marketing like an expert is not enough. We want to show you how to do both. I got an email just today from one of our users who's learning to become an expert, but not marketing like an expert. And I think he'll recognize it because he's on the line. But what I want to do is show you guys how to do both. And that's what it is all about, both of those things. And we're the only program that really puts it together. An example of our trial is on the next slide. We offer $9 a month for 60-day trial. And by the way, if you refer people in to the trial, just email us, let us know, and you can get up to 3 months free by referring others. I mentioned the Certified Mortgage Advisor Program. We have 9 required webinars, of which today is one of those. That also includes a 3-part mortgage planning segment. Is a required 10th webinar where you get at least 3 choices. I'm sorry, at least 7 choices. So there's some flexibility there. Plus, we have additional optional continuing education courses on a quarterly basis as well. You must attend these live, and it's your responsibility to track attendance. You know, even though we make the recordings available, that's for your convenience. It's not for certification. You'll get a test. It's open book. You should be able to pass an open book test. You'll get marketing materials, logos, flyers, seminars, and most importantly, a code of ethics. And that's why we do teach ethics as part of the CMA program. And I want to remind everybody, we are still working on 8 hours of continuing education credit. And when that does come through, we will be required to make some changes in the CMA format. It'll only affect if you want the credit. So just keep in mind that is still down, you know, coming, and we want to have that in place for the second half of the year when everybody's trying to get their 8 hours of industry-required credit. And the Newsletter Pro program we'll come back to later. And I mentioned RateLink, which soon should be Lender Outlook. And we'll be talking about that, you know, in much more detail at a future time. Okay, we covered the legislative update. We covered a few minutes on our package. Now let's get into the webinar, make sure we're ready to go because there's a lot of information we've got to go out today. This is a very complex topic, and as always, I hope to simplify it for you. History of self-employment. The nation added nearly 1 million businesses with no paid employees in 2004 to reach 19.5 million, which is up 4.7% from a year earlier. Now, what does that mean? Well, approximately 1 in 10 in the United States is self-employed. And keep in mind, you know, these readings were taken by the Census Bureau, and I expect the new ones to be released shortly. These were released before we went into an economic slump. And when an economic slump goes into comes into place, employment goes down, but self-employment often goes up because people who get displaced wind up opening their own businesses. So we're talking about one of the only segments of employment that has been increasing over the past half a decade. Now, why is self-employment important? Well, we've already talked about the growth of the population, but let's look at its role in the recession and the fiscal crisis that we all faced. One of the elements of the real estate boom, along with several other elements, was what we call loose lending by lenders. That includes the ability to do what we had nicknamed stated or liar loans. Well, the financial crisis was also caused by liar loans because we found out later that a lot of people were lying and really could not afford the homes that they had bought. The result is we must now document income based upon the new financial services law, the Dodd-Frank Act, and the qualified residential mortgage tightens it up even further with 28-36 ratios. FHA do not have no-doc loans, and VA is either, except streamline refis, and FHA has already added income verification for streamlines, though they don't actually specify ratios. Yet, while all this is happening, very few are teaching the analyzation of tax returns. It is a lost art. We had a whole decade of loan officers come in the industry who were taught, basically, that they don't need tax returns. Well, if you specialize in self-employment, you will differentiate yourself in the future. Larger loans, the bigger the income, the more likely your prospect is to be self-employed or have complex tax returns. And again, returning to the compensation plans, you know, the size of the loan, which always has been important with regard to your income, becomes even more important today because some of the other factors have been eliminated. Most commercial loans involve tax returns. So if you're doing commercial loans, you could be sure the tax returns are going to be involved, corporate and individual, and even in the aspects of marketing. I don't know a trainer who has not said at some point, you know, you should call on in CPAs because CPAs are a great referral source. People who make money have CPAs. Well, here's my point, and this is, you know, you have no right if you're not familiar with tax returns. I mean, think about this for a second. If you were a CPA and you were referring your client to a loan officer, would you want that loan officer to be somebody who does not understand tax returns? Absolutely not. And this is the best example I can give you between a great connection between marketing like an expert and being an expert, which is our premise for providing both ends of, you know, of what you need here to become successful, both marketing as an expert and being an expert. I can tell you that one of the things I did quickly in this industry, I did a $2.2 million loan, and that sounds big, but keep in mind this was 30 years ago. So that would be the equivalent of probably a $5-7 million loan today. And you could be assured the complexity of the tax returns were incredible. We didn't have automated back then. We didn't have stated back then. I learned tax returns very quickly. As a matter of fact, I started teaching originating self-employed or dealing with people who were self-employed to both loan officers and realtors very early in my career. So I knew how important it was, and I knew how important it was to get referrals by CPAs. I think the goal is great. But again, you have no right if you're not familiar with tax returns. Let's go to types of self-employment. And this is very broad, but again, I like to simplify. There are two major categories. No separate legal entity or a separate legal entity. And this is my subdivision, and I think this is important for you to understand. I'm doing this, you know, from an origination standpoint, not necessarily from a legal definition standpoint. No legal, separate legal entity, that's actually the easiest to analyze because everything is going to be contained on individual tax returns. Your most common would be a Schedule C, and the most common Schedule Cs typically are realtors or loan officers, though loan officers less so, you know, with FHA coming back and requiring loan officers to be W-2. And, you know, I expected that to change, but that never did happen. Though some lenders may have gone ahead, I'm not sure. It could also be miscellaneous income, such as capital gains, Schedule D, and rental income, Schedule E, for a real estate investor. If you think about what a real estate investor does, a real estate investor buys real estate, rents out real estate, and sells real estate. So they're going to have capital gains, and they're going to have rental income. It also can be a Schedule F for farm income, but keep in mind that most substantial farms, people live on those farms, and those loans become commercial. Those are not rural housing loans. Those are commercial loans. Now, if there's a separate legal entity, you could be assured those separate legal entities are going to be some sort of partnership or corporation. There are different variations of partnerships for corporations. For example, a subchapter S corporation is a closely held entity which has the characteristics of a partnership. For example, all income has to be removed out of the subchapter S every year. You can't leave profits in like you can with a regular corporation. This is also a limited liability corporation, which has the benefits of subchapter S, but less rules. And let me keep in mind that corporations themselves are regulated by the states, so you're going to see different variations and meanings. But the important things for you to understand that there are different types of just a regular partnership. There's a regular corporation. There's a subchapter S corporation. There's a limited liability corporation, and there are, you know, general partnerships and limited liability partnerships, and you need to understand the different types of partnerships and the implications of documentation of income from those different types. It gets more complex when there's a separate legal entity because basically you're going to have two sets of tax returns. Now, there are other self-employment issues besides are there one or two sets of tax returns. For example, not everybody who owns a corporation is self-employed. We have, generally in this industry, we have a 25% rule. We consider those, that really comes from the IRS, by the way. If somebody owns more than 25% of a corporation, they are considered self-employed. Where would you find that out? Well, for example, a partnership or a subchapter S corporation would have a document filed called the K-1. That K-1 is sort of like a W-2 for an employed person, but it's going to have certain information of which is important, is going to be their ownership percentage. If you got the corporate tax returns, you would also see the ownership percentage as well. Keep in mind, this is not a hard, fast rule. Just because somebody owns 23% doesn't mean the lender's not going to require tax returns. If it's a substantial corporation, they own 23% of it, they may very well consider themselves employed. You also must be able to analyze balance sheets for corporations and partnerships. That includes the cash assets, the short and long-term liability and retained earnings. We'll get back to that. Business credit is likely to be on a personal credit report, and therefore, there's the score of somebody who owns a business is likely to be affected negatively because there's credit on there which is not being satisfied with somebody's personal income, but the business income. I know it's sometimes it's intertwined, but sometimes just, you know, people run all their personal credit through their business, and that is something that can hurt their credit. 100% commission, but you're employed, for example, a loan officer. Even though you're considered employed, you're going to be treated as self-employed because all the rules of self-employment will apply to you. What are those rules? Well, you got to have a two-year history. They're going to average 2 years' income, and they're going to subtract your business expenses from that income. So if you look at it, those are the basic rules of self-employed. Two-year history, average 2 years, and subtract the business expenses. The difference is if somebody's self-employed, like a real estate agent, the business expenses would be listed on a Schedule C, which I've already mentioned. But if you are employed and on commission, it'll be listed on a Form 2106, which is also entitled Employee Business Expenses. And we'll show you these forms later on. Here's a big issue. What if somebody's self-employed less than 2 years? This was always a requirement for LIRA loans, at least 2 years self-employed. But that's a general rule as well, at least 2 years. But can they be approved? Well, I'm going to fire back at you. You know, a bunch of questions will help you understand the answer to the question on an individual case. For example, are they self-employed in the same line of work that they were employed in? For example, are they, you know, for example, were they the manager of a McDonald's and they bought that McDonald's? Is there high job demand if the business fails? I used to use lawyers 20 years ago as an example. Now there's more lawyers than jobs. So today I use nursing because nurses tend to get burned out. They open up these home health care businesses, but I could get 20 letters saying they could have a job anytime they wanted if their business failed. Obviously, 18 months self-employed is going to be much better than 6 months self-employed. Matter of fact, one of the rules I used to use, if they made enough money in 18 months to qualify, even if I divide the numerator by 24 months, then that's a good candidate. Is there guaranteed income for the future? For example, do they have a contract they're working under? You know, a lot of consultants actually have contracts they work under which guarantee income for certain years in the future. Did they buy a present business like a McDonald's that is more than 2 years, that is, you know, has been out there more than 2 years? Well, again, if I was buying a McDonald's and I was experienced in running McDonald's, that McDonald's may have been there for 30 years. I can get plenty of corporate tax returns to show it's an established business. I didn't just start up the business. What does the rest of the file look like? Of course. You know, what's the LTV? What's the credit score? What are the cash assets? I mean, you got $1 million in the bank. You got a 30%. You know, LTV, and you got an 800 credit score. I know I'm exaggerating here, but you're much more likely to get an exception in that situation. Again, we're talking about exceptions. That means every lender and every underwriter within each lender is going to be different in this regard because there's no steadfast rules. Now, what documentation is required? That may vary by lender or automated underwriting system. Though I can tell you, even though Fannie or Freddie did not have stated income loans, they had what I call backdoor no income verification. In other words, if the loan was strong enough, the automated system would only require a telephone verification or maybe only a P&L, and that was it. Well, obviously, Fannie and Freddie have tightened up as well. Standard documentation is 2 years individual returns, 2 years corporate returns, if there is a separate legal entity, a year-to-date P&L, an IRS 4506 so that the lender can pull their own returns, and most of the time a business credit report is not required. Again, most expenses are run through personal reports. We're talking full returns here, not just schedules. We're talking federal returns here, not state. And then we're also making sure that the returns are ratified or signed. So there's your general documentation requirement. Now, I mentioned profit and loss statements several times. Is the profit and loss statement always required? Well, obviously, automated underwriting systems sometimes don't require them. But more and more, they are being required. And the issue technically is timing. As a matter of fact, I want you to think about the, you know, if you think about a Schedule K-1 as being the equivalent of a W-2, you can think of a P&L as the equivalent of a year-to-date pay stub. Basically, the lender is going to want to see the income be updated to within the most recent quarter. So I'll give you an example. If you take a loan in February and they've already filed their tax returns for last year, P&L is not going to help you. On the other hand, if you take a loan in August and their tax returns are filed through, you know, January, that means you have a period from January to July which is not covered at all, and the P&L will cover it. So it's a timing and issue. You basically want to present the business income, you know, up and through the most recent quarter, not typically 30 days, but I guess a lender could ask for it. Now, one thing you need to watch for, a fiscal versus a calendar year. Individuals are always on a calendar year. So if they're a Schedule C, it's calendar year, don't worry about it. However, partnerships and corporation can be on a fiscal year. Now, what's a fiscal year? Simply, a fiscal year is anything that's not a calendar year. So a year that starts January 2nd and ends January 1st would be a fiscal year. Now, the most common fiscal year is actually October 1st to September 30th because that's the fiscal year of the federal government. That's the date by which Congress is supposed to pass a budget and never has, by the way, at least in my recent memory, passed the budget on time. Even subcontractors that contract with the government, like defense contractors, often use the fiscal year budget because they're serving somebody. Generally, to me, a fiscal year is a tax strategy because the tax strategy or a fiscal year will actually straddle the calendar year. In other words, if it's December 31st, I'm in a fiscal year, and I could decide December 31st whether I want to pay myself salary, which means I'll owe taxes on it, by April 15th. On the other hand, I could wait till January 2nd. I'm still in the same fiscal year, and then pay myself the salary, and then actually owe taxes on that salary a year from April 15th. So it's a great, great, advantageous tax strategy for a small business. I'm not saying that's the only reason to do it. Some people do it because they start their business May 1st, so they start their fiscal year May 1st. So it could be very, very simple. But it does make it complex, because when you ask for a year-to-date P&L, you actually want to do it on a fiscal year-to-date, because the corporate tax returns are going to end, you know, at the end of the fiscal year, not the end of the calendar year. Next question, should the P&L be signed by an accountant, or is it okay to be signed by an individual? you'll often have a lender ask for what I considered really dated guidelines, because people used to have this in the guidelines, you know, years ago. And I used to argue with underwriters decades ago about this when they asked for audited tax returns. What they really mean are tax returns signed by an accountant. They don't really mean that those are going to be audited. There's actually three levels of audit that are done by accountants. There are review, compilation, and a full audit. I think Jimmy's on the line. If he's still there, he's the CPA. He'll verify that. And you're not going to get fully audited tax returns. I mean, if you own a mortgage broker, you know what an audit's like, and it costs thousands of dollars. If you cost your prospect thousands of dollars because you don't understand what audited means, that would be a big faux pas, obviously. So really, it's going to be a compilation that the accountant signs. But the question is, can sometimes the individual sign them? And the answer is, you need to look at the aspects of the file. Is the income the same as the income in the tax returns? Is it not increasing at all? If that's the case, it's more easily to be relied upon. Is there a way of verifying the income that's on the P&L independently? For example, if they're a real estate agent, I can go to the real estate company and verify their income independently from their accounting office or human resource department. So that is, you know, those are ways that we can, you know, verify independently and give an underwriter confidence about the P&L without having an accountant sign it. I mean, for, you know, if somebody's a real estate agent and they do their own tax returns, you know, there's just no reason to have an audited P&L in my mind. Another issue is if there is a separate corporation, again, you need to separate the income from the borrower out. The income paid as salary can be used, but income paid to other employees or salaries paid to other employees can't be used. If the P&L only has one line and it says salaries, that is going to be an issue. You need it broken out. And at the same time, you also need to know when that salary was paid. Remember the straddling I talked about? You know, because the fiscal year could have paid that salary in any one of two calendar years. And so therefore, I need to know when the salary was paid out so I can calculate the income correctly. Now let's talk about figuring the income. First of all, can you use salary paid by the corporation to the applicant? The answer is yes, but it must be supported. For example, if somebody pays themselves $50,000 in salary, but the corporation loses $50,000, guess what? It's not supported. And in addition, no matter what you call it, I don't care if you call it salary, dividends, commission, you know, just net profit, whatever you call it on the tax returns, and I've seen it called anything, it still must be average. Don't get lost in the fact that they're calling it salary, so it must be constant. It's not. I've had somebody pay himself salary and then pay himself a bonus. It was all variable. Now, if there's a loss on the corporation, they paid themselves salary, you might have to subtract the loss by their percentage of ownership. So in the case where they paid themselves $50,000, but the partnership or the corporation lost $50,000, but he only owns 50% of it, in that case, I might take $25,000 out. The key is the two-year average of net income, not gross revenues. I know we use gross income when we use salary, but the truth is the gross income on a salaried person is the same as the net income on a self-employed person, because the net income is what they pay taxes on. It's two definitions of net versus gross here. Let me give you an example. We're going to take a very simple example. Somebody makes $50,000 in 2007. They made $70,000 in 2008 and $40,000 year to date, 2009 through through June 30th. That's a very simple and good example because the income's going up. If I take an 18-month average, that's going to be a little bit over $6,000. That's 2008 and half of 2009. If I take a full-year average, that's 2008 and 2007, and that's going to be $5,000. If I take the most recent two-year average, which would be half of 2007, all of 2008, and the first half of 2009, now I'm up to $5,600. Or I could take a 30-month average, which is 5,333. Now, a couple of points here. Number one, they're all mathematically correct, at least I believe they are. Number two, the shorter their average, the higher the income. Why? Because the income is going up, okay? Which is right, believe it or not. All are acceptable at times. Obviously, when the income's rising, I want to push for the shorter one. Well, I've got to, you know, if I want to use an 18-month average, I might have to argue and document why the income will not fall back. Maybe that person has got guaranteed income in the future. The one thing that's not acceptable is just using 2009 or just using the P&L. Just using the P&L for 2009. But let me reverse that situation. If the underwriter sees that the income is declining, the underwriter might argue to use just 2009 because the income is declining. Now, that sounds like a catch-22 for you, you know, because, and it's not fair because when income's going up, you got to use a long average. When the income's going down, they want to use a short average. My solution to that is go back 5 years when the income's declining and show a better pattern. If you can show that it was just one bad year out of five, the income is not really declining. It's normal variation. One bad year out of five, in fact, is better than 1 year out of two. Just because typical documentation is 2 years tax returns doesn't mean you can't go back and get 5 years. I go back to that term idiot form. What's an idiot form? My problem with idiot forms, and it goes back to my friend who, in the old days, again, you know, four decades ago, when I first got a car, you know, we had gauges on cars. And then we went to lights. And what my friend argued was, when the oil got low, nobody would check the oil unless the light went on. So he called them idiot lights. Well, that's the same thing with the forms. I've sort of taken that nickname and applied it to self-employment forms where you fill in the blanks. You know, your key is to be able to argue a case to get yours accepted. If you just fill in the lines, you know, if, for example, the CPA put a number on a different line, you can completely throw yourself out by thousands of dollars. I want you to understand tax returns. I want you to be able to explain tax returns. As a matter of fact, I believe, you know, one of the things that you should be doing is taking a tax return preparation course. And I think it's a great thing for you to learn, but it's also a great way of marketing because the people that leave that course are going to be potential people who can refer you deals. And I like, as you can see, I like tying marketing to education. Last thing on this line is capital gains. That's a special case. It's what I call a super variable. Most lenders require a three-year average and proof that the asset will continue to produce gains. For example, if somebody was selling stocks and the stock is gone, even if they had 3 years, there's no probability of continuance. Now, here's the real dilemma here. The real dilemma is the purpose of filing taxes. The purpose of filing taxes is to minimize the taxes you pay. I don't care if you're a conservative or you're a liberal. Nobody likes paying taxes. And I don't blame them. I don't like it. Now, the purpose of tax returns for a loan is to show the maximum income possible. Well, those two objectives will never meet. So therefore, what I want to do is I always want to look for places that income could be hiding in there. And I just want to take a break for a second. I see people are submitting questions in. I thank you very much and comments. And keep in mind that it's really important for you to interact here. At the end of the webinar, we will be taking questions. So that is extremely, extremely important. So, four places to find income hiding. One, I would call non-cash flow items. That's probably the most common. For example, depreciation on either individual corporate returns. You buy a car, you depreciate it. That's not a cash loss every year. Now, you may have to replace that car. I mean, cars do depreciate. Or even carryover losses. Though I always have, there's another red flag there. If the corporation has carryover losses and those carryover losses caused the loss this year, keep in mind they were still losses in the past, and the owner is going to look at that as a bad sign that there were losses and may require previous returns. Shared expenses, and what I mean there are shared between personal and business use. Mostly they're going to be credit items. Loans, again, they're because people, self-employed people, small self-employed people, I don't mean short, I mean small businesses, use their personal lines of credit to fund their business. They can take out loans, they can take out credit cards, they can actually, have the business in the house and write off part of their mortgage. They can use the car. I mean, somebody, for example, the realtor doesn't have one car to go to the grocery and one car to take prospects around. They have one car. That's it. And that car they're going to write off on their business. But, of course, that car loan is going to be in their back ratio already. So, in essence, if you put it in the back ratio and then you subtract the expense from the business, you're double counting that. Even health insurance, gets written off. And, keep in mind, they're paying health insurance. That's a personal expense. Now, keep in mind also, mathematically, you have two choices there if something's being double counted, like a car loan or a car lease. If you subtract it from the income or you take it out from the back ratio, you're going to get two very different answers. And usually, taking out of the back ratio is going to give you a better result. But underwriters are going to be more reticent to let you take it out of the back ratio unless you can show the business is paying for it directly. There are also optional items. I really only have two, and really only one that's important, because it's so hard to prove. If you're going to the IRS and saying, I needed that expense, then now I'm going to the lender and say, no, I didn't need that expense. Well, two things. Number one, charitable expenses by their very nature are optional. However, they're usually not substantial. Now, contributions to a retirement plan can be substantial. As a matter of fact, it's one of the very reasons people get self-employed, because with a profitable business, you can sock a lot more money into a retirement plan. And keep in mind, if you were salaried and you had a retirement plan like a 401k or you made an IRA contribution, we would subtract that 401k from your income. So why would we subtract it from a self-employment income? I would argue that, number one, it's optional. Number two, it's conservative. They're putting the money away. It's better than spending it. And number three, if the retirement plan was big enough, I mean, in that $2.2 million loan I talked about, I had to use not only their contribution to the retirement plan, but I used the growth of that retirement plan, which was non-taxable, but it was huge. And frankly, he didn't pay himself enough salary to qualify. There's also one-time expenses that will not reoccur because they're also hard to prove. They're very hard to prove. For example, if somebody has an expense due to a flood, you can't prove there's not going to be a flood the following year. But I will give you one example that I've used before in the past. For example, somebody builds a website. Once you build the website, you may have, let's say you spend $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $100,000 building an elaborate website. You don't have to rebuild that website again and again. It doesn't depreciate. You may have maintenance costs you're now going to have to add. But, you know, that's an example of a one-time expense. It'd be your option ever to do it again in the future. Submitting the file, very, very important. First, you want to put it in the right order, cover letter first, P&L on top of the tax returns, and most recent tax returns first. Second, you want to highlight the tax returns, and you could do that with PDFs if you're submitting electronically. You want to follow the numbers you use in your cover letter. We'll get to that in a moment. You want to move the underwriter eyes to where you want to move them. That's called leading them through the file. You want to make it easy on the underwriter. If it is a physical file, you want to tab it. Typically, the file's legal size, the returns are letter size, the file's thick, and the underwriter must flip from year to year, which, by the way, could take files. I mean, underwriters hate thick self-employment files. Well, if you can tab it to the pages that you use so they can flip the Schedule C from last year to the Schedule C from the year before very quickly, you're going to make life easier on them, and they're going to be in a good mood. And the key is for an underwriter to be in a good mood when they work on your file. I mean, let me ask you a question. Do they run away from your file, or do they grab your file first? Because that is the whole ball game. If you can lead them through the file, make a good argument, and make it easy on them, you want them in a good mood, because good moods means less conditions and a better and more likely to get exceptions. Now, I mentioned cover letter. Why? You're the client's representative. The underwriter just sees a bunch of papers. You need to put the human element in the file. This is where you learn your commission. But especially in self-employment, if you put income numbers on the 1003 and 1008, the underwriter has no idea how you derive those numbers. Therefore, they're going to start from scratch, and you have very little chance they will come up with the same numbers. Your job is to convince them to use your numbers, and this is your only chance where you can explain it. Think about it for a second. How often does the underwriter change your numbers on a self-employed file? You want to change that. Cover letter format, only one page with short bullets. Don't make it into another task. General description of the situation, positive aspects of the file, show the income and ratio calculations. This is key for self-employed. Describe the issues, not negatives, and then compensating factors to overcome the issues. So, what I'm giving you is an example of a cover letter here, and what I'm going to do for the rest of the webinar is I am going to basically use this as a basis of our case study. The one thing I want to make you understand is I'm using all even numbers here. I don't want to get this into become a math exercise. I want you to understand it. So let's look at the cover letter. This file is for a purchase loan from John and Mary Smith. The Smiths are experienced homeowners who are selling their present home in order to move closer to the school their child's attending. I've just put the human face on it. They've got children. You know, they're interested in schooling. They're putting 20% down, which is coming from the sale of the present home. A seller net sheet outlining the expected proceeds is in the file, along with the sales contract for their present home. The settlements are expected to be back-to-back, and thus we're requesting approval subject to this settlement and minimum proceeds of blank dollars. Note, two things here. Number one, I always want to state my expected conditions in there. I'm helping the underwriter so they don't miss anything. And number two, my goal is only to get the conditions that I want, that I expect. And that's my job. We talked about that last week in the great application system. The goal is to control the whole process. And a little second note in here. The minimum proceeds needed to settle, not what the net sheet says. If the net sheet says they're going to get $100,000 but they only need $20,000, then the conditions should say $20,000, which is what they need. The Smiths are both self-employed. In this cover letter, we wanted to make sure that I explain the calculation of income and ratio. Mr. Smith owns 100% of a corporation. Mrs. Smith is the sole proprietor. We're using a 27-month average for both. So I wanted to give you a good example of both. Now, keep in mind, on the 1003, I would be separating the two incomes out. But for the purposes of the cover letter and to fit it all on one slide, I actually just lumped it together. I have Mr. Smith's salary for 27 months. I've got the net profit of the corporation. Notice I've got footnotes. Depreciation of the corporation. I've got the retirement plan. I've got Mrs. Smith's net profit, so now we're on Mrs. Smith. We've got her pension plan. We have the car lease. Okay, we have interest and dividends. And then we have rental income. So now I've taken the annual income, and I simply divided it by 27 months. Math-wise, it's very simple. Let's look at some of the footnotes on this letter, because this is, I put a lot of situations in there, so I wanted to explain it. Mr. Smith owns 100% of the corporation and could have taken this money out of salary. This footnote has to do with the net income of the corporation. However, he consistently leaves the money in, which is conservative. See retained earnings on the balance sheet. Note that the year-to-date profit is higher than previous years. However, he's not obligated to pay the salary out into the year-end. This is a perfect example of explaining a situation, because the underwriter can say, oh, that salary looks higher. Of course it's higher, because he hasn't paid his salary out yet. So that's footnote number one, which is net profit of the corporation. Footnote number two is the retirement plan. There's a letter from the accountant indicating the contribution is the sole benefit to Mr. Smith. It's not employee retirement plan. Contributions voluntary can be ended at any time. Note the retirement plan has built up to $300,000. Income from this plan is not taxable, but we have not used income, this income anyway. There's no contribution year to date because this does not have to be done until year end. Again, in the middle of the year, you don't make your contribution. Note number three, I'm sorry, went in the wrong direction. Footnote number three has to do with Mrs. Smith's retirement plan. We make the same exact note. Actually, I should have changed that note to show the size of her plan, but otherwise the concept should be the same. Number four has to do with the car lease. The $300 a month car lease is added back in because it's included in the back ratio and shouldn't be double counted. Dividends include payment from the corporation. So in other words, he's paying himself salary, but he's also paying himself dividends. Remember, I don't care what he calls it. It's going to be average. And the non-taxable interest is grossed up by 25%. Depreciation is added back in. That's footnote 6 on the rental income, because on the tax returns, it looks like a loss until you see the depreciation added back in. And then I add, the P&L for Mrs. Smith was not compiled by an accountant, but it's very consistent with the previous years. In addition, we have verified her year-to-date income through real estate company via VOE. So you notice I hit most of these concepts, and then we would follow this income with the way I calculated the ratios. You know, I'd actually use a calculator, not an automated system for my cover letter. So now here is Mary Smith's P&L, which is for the first 3 months of the year. And notice she has no pension in there. And there's some car expenses in there. And then this is the Mr. Smith's corporation's gross P&L. There you've got employee salaries that are broken out from salary to officer. And you've got depreciation in there as well. So we want to make note of those things. here is the 1040, which is the individual tax returns. I wanted to show you. Look at line 7. That's your wages. That's where he pays himself salary. 8-9A are the dividends that came from the corporation where he paid himself in a strange way. But you know what? He's allowed to do that, I guess. You know, it might depend upon the way the corporation's set up. Business income, line 12, that's the bottom line of the Schedule C, the net Schedule C. There's $10,000 in capital gains. I didn't really use that. There's the rental loss, okay? And notice we also have $10,000 on line 28 that was towards a self-employment plan. That would have been her self-employment plan on the Schedule C, or funded by the Schedule C. Itemized deductions. I want to, you know, most of those are pretty self-explanatory, home mortgage interest, but I wanted to call your attention to line 21. Those are job expenses. I didn't have to do this, but again, for teaching purposes, I wanted you to see where we're deducting the business expenses for the car. In this case, I used a 2106. So in essence, this would have been from him. Basically, I'm assuming that they're writing off the car expenses using his salary. It's an expense for him, not her. Now, I could have had, you know, car leases for both of them. I just wanted to simplify it. But notice, you know, basically the vehicle expenses are $8,200. And then some other stuff written off as well. That's well above the car lease, I think, amount. That's carried over to Schedule A, miscellaneous deductions. Now, once again, she could have written them off directly on her Schedule C if it was her car. Interest and dividends. I just wanted to show you the dividends from the Smith Consulting Agency. There were $4,000. That is also income from the corporation. Here's her Schedule C, which is really just another P&L. But just like her P&L, she does have car and truck expenses in that case, $10,000. So they're both writing off cars. You've also, she doesn't have any depreciation, though that could be included in the car expenses, depreciating the car, though they typically wouldn't do that with a lease. And the $10,000 for the pension and profit sharing plan is in there. Schedule E, rental property, notice the loss, $4,700. However, the depreciation on line 20 is more than that $4,700 loss. Here are the corporate tax returns, or at least the first page. Note, you want to go to the very bottom. You got $238 in deductions and a $7,000 net profit. A profit is good. Most corporations take the profit out, small corporations take the profit out every year, so it's not double taxed. I mean, if you keep it in there, they have to pay corporate tax rates on it, and then when he pays it out as salary later on, he has to pay individual tax rate. So most remove as much profit as possible. You notice you'll see compensation for officers on line 12 as being separate, and you also see depreciation on line 20. Those are all important. Oh, and also line 23, the pension and profit sharing plan. That's his contribution to his plan versus the $10,000 to hers. Notice this would be on the fourth page of the corporate return. There it is specified how much John Smith owns and how much of that salary to officers actually went to him. This is where sort of it's verified that all $100,000 was his. I mentioned balance sheets before. Here's the balance sheet. The balance sheet, I think, is on either page 2 or 3 of the corporate returns. And there you get to look at the cash assets, beginning of the year, end of the year, or last year to this year. You can look at short-term loans and also what's called retained earnings, which becomes a liability. That's the way balance sheets work. So they all amount to zero. But retained earnings is actually a positive thing. It means in the past, the corporation has made a profit and they kept some of that money in that corporation. So we've got, other things we could be looking for example, would be accounts payable, which is going up, not drastically. Loans payable than less than a year. For example, if this corporation had $1 million in loans that were due in the next year, a underwriter would definitely take note of that. Okay, we're through the forms. Once again, you'll be able to go back and look at them. Marketing self-employed, I want to spend a few moments on this, though we've really started already. Remember, you're talking about bigger loans. That means bigger commissions. Start with your sphere and your network. I always say that, but not everybody listens. Self-employed are more likely to have CPAs. That's why you want to know tax returns. They're also more likely to have financial planners. Business brokers, that help people buy businesses, they know a lot of people who are self-employed. The Chamber of Commerce, small business owners are likely to be members of the Chamber of Commerce. Also, go to any networking group, you're going to see small business owners. Maybe they own an insurance agency. Corporate lawyers, what do? Well, they help people, start corporations. They file articles of corporation. Obviously, they know business owners. This is a great seminar for upscale realtors. You'd have to, bring it down. You could bring this down to 4 or 5 slides. I presented this to realtors when I was a loan officer. Self-employed are more likely, to have challenges such as credit and debts. Why is credit more of an issue? Because credit scores do not take into account the fact that business credit is being paid by a separate income. They're just taking into account the fact that there's more credit. And keep in mind, I gave you a hint before. If you went to a school to learn how to prepare tax returns, and they're not, you don't have to go for 2 years. They're typically could be a 2-week class at night. You don't want to necessarily go to an H&R Block class, but a class where you're going to have real CPAs in there trying to brush up and, a varied amount of different people because, H&R Block, my guess is half of those people that go through drop out. You want the best attendance there because everybody who's there is a potential person to help you get or refer business to you. Marketing and education should not be separate. My synergy rule number one says that everything you do should have a separate objective. Why Newsletter Pro? Not going to spend a lot of time on it today because this was definitely a subject with a lot of material in it. But I want to remind everybody, if you have not gotten your logon password, you can't get into the system. That means tomorrow on the right-hand side of the dashboard, you can't get in to download the slides and the audio and register for next week's webinar, which I believe is going to be an update on FHA guidelines. We've had a lot of changes, and I want to always get people up to date about what could be coming and what has already come down the pike. This is also where you set up your update, your profile, and where you can access all the Newsletter Pro marketing system documents. In other words, you've got everything for Newsletter Pro, and you got everything for the Certified Mortgage Advisor on one dashboard. It may not look pretty, but it serves its purpose, certainly. And updating your profile is very simple. This is what our consumer newsletter, looks like. And, this should go out to every everybody in your sphere. And if you haven't sat through our sphere marketing webinar, you know, it is so important to understand how large your sphere is. This is cheap to get out. You get it every week. It takes 15 minutes to really, you know, to personalize it. And then you get it every week and get it out. It is very, very simple. We have other documents as well. Our four-page mailing newsletter. Our sales update, which, by the way, is perfect for CPAs. It's not just for realtors. It is a general sales update. That's why we write it like that. And then real estate page articles. I think I've even done an article in the past about, you know, self-employment and mortgages in the past. We have a great archive of these. On one-page newsletters and flyers and letters. And we're really going to build up this section in the next year. That is our next step forward. And a reminder about our special again. Again, if you did not get your logon and password, email us at success@hirschmangroup.com so that we can get you started. We can even give you a tour and help you set up your profile if you don't know how to do that. Okay, running just a few minutes late, but I think we're pretty much on time. Let's get to questions, comments, and more. This is a comment from Jimmy. April 18th is also the tax return filing deadline. Use 4868 if you need an extension. I would like to mention again that Jimmy is not only a broker, but he's also a CPA. I mean, to me, that's the best of both worlds, having both of them together in one expertise. And so listen to what he has to say. I think it's the 18th falls on probably Monday, which is why it's a couple days later than normal than the April 15th. And I think it's the 18th is Monday. I'm not 100% sure. This is from Kenneth. How much paperwork can be eliminated by a self-employed submitting a CPA letter? You know, a lot of lenders took CPA letters, you know, in the past, a letter from a CPA or verbal verification, and so they didn't require the tax returns. But my assumption today, with the tightening up of underwriting requirements and the verification of underwriting requirements, are that most lenders are requiring full tax returns today. If I'm wrong, let me know that. And even if they're not requiring them, they're requiring a 4506 or 8821, whatever that other form is, so that they can pull the tax returns themselves independently before they approve the loan. So you might as well just give it to them. So I'm not seeing that CPA letters would be used to eliminate a lot of paperwork today. But again, you guys may be having some different experiences, so let me know about that. Okay, 25% and get W-2 underwriting the same as a corporate LLC. John, not sure of your question. A W-2 would be used for somebody who's salaried. Well, you know, maybe I do understand the question. I think maybe you're saying if somebody owns 25% of a corporation, if I just get the W-2, is that okay? And again, I think I'm going to give the same answer as I gave Ken before, was that I think most lenders today are going, if they own 25% of the corporation, they're going to require corporate returns. Again, I'm saying most, because there's no rule in the industry that you have to. Can a lender require a CPA versus a PA? That also is from John. John, not sure what you mean by PA. Power of attorney, that could be a power of attorney. Are you referring to P&L? Okay, no, I think I understand what you're saying. I'm sorry, I'm thinking of loans, and You're talking about somebody who's not a certified public accountant. Can a lender require a CPA versus a regular public accountant? I'm sorry. I'm just, you know, after the webinar, I'm not always 100% there. You know what? Let me say it by this. It should not make a difference. On the other hand, there's another rule in this industry. The rule is, he who has the gold makes the rules. And today, we've got more rules than we've ever had. So a lender says, I want a CPA, not just an accountant. I guess they can say it. Technically, in my mind, there should be no difference. I mean, you know, somebody's an accountant, they have an accountant practice, they're licensed as an accountant. You know, they should be able to, you know, prepare a P&L. Now, I know, Jimmy, you're a CPA. If you want to present an opposing opinion, I just got a note from Jimmy. Great job, Dave. Got to go now. So obviously he's not going to, but if somebody has a different opinion, let me know. Is the file cover page available in Excel format to personalize? To me, a cover page is like a memo, not an Excel format. You know, remember, I was dealing with two self-employed people, so therefore there was a lot of numbers there. But could you do it in an Excel format? I guess you could, but is it available? The answer is not. I apologize, but I'll have to say I'm sorry on that. It is not. Typically, when I did a cover letter, I do it as a memo, a Word document, where I just put numbers in it and show them, you know, how it's calculated, you know, X amount divided by, because I'm really trying to tell a story there. I'm trying to tell a story. John said public accountant. I figured that one all by myself. Sorry about that. You mentioned grossing up dividends by 25%. Could you explain that in more detail? Great question. I apologize. Sometimes I have to flip over things. Any dividends or interest that, you know, you have a two-year history of and are going to continue that are non-taxable typically should be grossed up. Now, there's two ways of grossing them up. You know, and what I'm saying by gross up there, I mean, think about it this way. If you get $1,000 tax-free, you understand it's worth more than $1,000 that's taxable from an income standpoint. So the question is, how much more? Well, if you get $1,000 and you're in a 33% tax bracket, and if you could prove that mathematically using, you know, the tax tables, that $1,000 is actually $1,333 in income. Remember, we use the income before somebody pays taxes on it, which is gross income. Don't confuse that with the net income on the Schedule C. However, most people in this industry use a standard, and most lenders will let you use a standard that says, hey, they're non-taxable. You can just gross it up by 25%. So that $1,000 actually becomes $1,250 gross income for you to use in qualification. Non-taxable income, that's what we're talking about there. David, it says David, somebody registered under my generic link. And by the way, I want to make that very, very clear. If you registered under the generic link, we have no proof that you attended this webinar other than your phone number, which is why we always use a separate phone number, not a computer phone number. But you got to let us know that you did that right after the webinar. Otherwise, there's a chance you're not going to get credit for this webinar towards the CMA. We do follow rules here, even though we're not regulated by the government. I want to make sure if somebody, you know, challenges your credentials, we have the records to show for it. Does the 2836 truly become effective in the Dodd-Frank bill in July? Good question, David. And that is a David. That's not a David Hirschman, David. It is pursuant to the Dodd-Frank bill, but it would become effective when the regulations are effective. The regulations have been proposed. There's a 30-day comment period. When they're finalized, that when, you know, when they're effective. Are they aiming for July 1st? Possibly, because that's when the target date is for Dodd-Frank. But if there's a lot of controversy, if they're a legal challenge, there could be major delays. So it could be before July 1st, or it could be after July 1st. And keep in mind, that doesn't mean you can't do loans with a higher ratio than 2836. What it means, you know, you can still do FHA loans, Fannie Mae loans, Freddie Mac loans, VA loans. Those are exempted. You can still do loans that are beyond 2836 if the bank's willing to do them with mortgage insurance, let's say, but they would have to put 5% skin in the game to retain, you know, to retain part of the risk. In essence, it is likely those loans will cost more. You know, I've been talking about credit scores and loan level pricing adjustments and FDI for years now, and this rule is going to make loan level pricing adjustments even more severe, unless something happens with it. Okay, thanks, John, for your comment. Looks like I got through most of the written questions. There's always one I've missed or something. We're right on time. I want to open up the lines just to see if there's anything I missed or anybody wants to ask a question verbally. So give me about 10 seconds and I'll be there.